Thank you, Your Honor. May it please the court. My name is David Hargett and represent Mr. Davison. His appeals out of his convictions out of the city of Fredericksburg. I will note first and foremost that this court had granted the jury instruction issue but had denied our sufficiency of the evidence argument. But I think that the facts related to the how strongly contested this case was really kind of helps understand or assist with the analysis that we have with regard to the jury instruction. And so from the onset, I would say that the defendant nor the complaining witness necessarily made good decisions here. But this is not a question of morals. This is a question of did Mr. Davison commit specific criminal acts?
Well, and let me ask you the question. And obviously, you had a sufficiency assignment. Given its resolution and the posture win, would you agree that there was sufficient evidence to submit the charges to the jury on a theory of threat, force, or intimidation?
Yes.
Okay. Would you also agree that there was sufficient evidence to submit the charges to the jury on a theory of helplessness, whether physical or mental?
Yes.
Okay. So the only problem is that they were both submitted or that they were both submitted in one instruction?
That's correct. That's correct. And we have Molina that assumes without deciding that that's the wrong thing to do.
Well, I mean, the dissent in Molina actually says it's the wrong thing to do, but that distinguishes the majority from the dissent. In Molina, the court punted on that question.
Well, right. The Supreme Court later on.
Well, both courts punted.
Well, yes. Eventually, yes. But they did assume without deciding. And so now this court is really called upon the task of deciding.
If your theory is correct, then wouldn't every conviction using Virginia Model Jury Instruction 48-600, the threat, force, or intimidation charge, be similarly infirm because it's in the disjunctive as well?
No. Clearly not every disjunctive needs a separate jury instruction for you to get there. But it's the act that's important, the specific act that's being committed. And what distinguishes, and that's why we lump together the physical helplessness or the mental incapacity, because those are so closely related, and they also have the additional element that you need to know or reasonably should have known that the person is not capable of giving consent. That's a completely different way to get to the guilty verdict than it is to actually use force to overcome someone's will. And so the question is, did the jury make a unanimous decision as to the specific act that was the criminal act?
Well, the criminal act, isn't it, regardless of whether you believe it's threat, force, or intimidation, or physical or mental helplessness, is performing sexual acts without consent. That's the act. The other ways are means and avenues of accomplishing the act, but that's the act that's charged, correct?
Well, yes, but I mean, it's just more than just not against their consent because, again, you have to look at the different paths and how different they really are in order to make the determination. In other words, let's back up for a second. Let's assume for the sake of argument that some of the jury members didn't believe that she was incapacitated or helpless, but believed that it was by force, threat, or intimidation that he overcame her will. Let's also assume that others assume that he didn't do that. So you really don't know what they convicted him of. And that's where the unanimous verdict requirement comes into place.
Well, would you agree that the suitor plurality opinion in Shad versus Arizona is the rule of decision?
The rule of decision, but not as applicable to this particular set of facts.
Well, in Shad, you had the Arizona instruction that was both premeditated murder and felony murder in the same instruction. And the argument that was made is very similar to the argument you're making now. We don't know if six of the jurors may have concluded that it was a premeditated murder, and others may conclude it was an accidental killing in the course of a robbery. And so we don't have a unanimous verdict on how, we just have a unanimous verdict that we had a first degree murder, and the Supreme Court of the United States said that was okay.
But you have the same act. an act that is premeditated, of course, that depends on the person's intent. An act that is a killing in the commission of another offense, i.e. felony murder, it's still the same act. So that's what I'm talking about here.
Well, you know, here the act is on rape, it's penetration on, I mean, that's the act, right?
Well, no, because if he did something that was with force or threat or intimidation, that's a different act than doing something without force, threat, or intimidation, but just taking advantage of somebody else's inability, I guess, to say no or say stop. So you have two, and that's why, and I'll point this out because it's one of the two instructions that we're talking about here, the aggravated sexual battery instruction. The model jury instructions has one for force, threat, or intimidation, and then a second one, for physical or mental helplessness or incapacity. So, and the reason why is, I think, quite clear, because there are really two different ways to get there. And I think that we have, at least Molina is a strong indication that they should be separated out. And I think that other courts and other jurisdictions have struggled with this. And I can't really put my finger on whether what my side is arguing is the majority or the minority side. But and I appreciate the respondent pointing out to the Martin versus Commonwealth case, where they basically struggle with the same exact idea and decided that you need to have that those jury instructions should have been separated out because there's impossible to know how the jury reached its verdict. And that's the specific act that we're talking about, not just maybe level of intent. And I would, you know, like to read from the Martin versus Commonwealth. Of course, that's a Kentucky case. By Commonwealth, I'm not suggesting that it's Virginia. It's Kentucky. And they say, basically, we cannot be sure that the jurors were unanimous, including that the defendant committed a single act satisfying the instruction. And so the defendant could be convicted without necessarily a unanimous conclusion that he committed the single act beyond a reasonable doubt. And that's the same thing we have here. Again, an act done with force or an act not done with force are two different acts. And because they're different acts, you need to know what the jury was deciding. Now, I've raised this jury verdict argument, and I'm sure the respondent will address it, because it's really another way to analyze this situation. So let's say, for instance, we had a jury verdict form that said the defendant is guilty of aggravated sexual battery or sodomy, whichever, those are the two offenses we're talking about here, by using his will, his force to overcome her will, or a separate line, we find him guilty based on physical helplessness, taking advantage of her physical helplessness or mental incapacity. And I think that it makes it clear to the jury that they need to pick one or the other. If they can't agree that it was done this way in this particular set of facts, then they can't agree on the verdict. And that's the problem here. This court cannot then look back on that and say, well, we know what the jury was probably thinking, or we know what the jury was doing, because that's the wrong entity making the decision in this case. And so, you know, when you look at the facts that support that she consented, you have her pursuing him, jumping in the truck, wanting to go have some fun. And if she consented, we have that jury instruction, that if she consented, that it's a complete bar to prosecution for any of these offenses. The facts that show that she was aware or conscious, not physically helpless or not mentally incapacitated, was that when she left the bar, yeah, sure, she had a fair amount to drink. But the people who observed her said she wasn't stumbling. She was walking, talking, carrying on. She was the one pursuing him. She's not considered to be a vulnerable person. She's considered to be a strong person. That was the evidence in the case. And then when she returned, not only did she not want to involve the police, she just wanted to go home. She told her friend, no, don't worry about it, let's just go home. And she was, once inevitably the police got there, and the person who did the initial assessment of her determined that she was a 15 out of 15 on the Glasgow scale, meaning that she was fully alert, fully aware and fully conscious. So a jury really is going to have to pick one or the other, especially with these facts. They're going to have to decide, did he take her somewhere and rape her, et cetera, et cetera? Or did he take her somewhere and then she just passed out and he did other things to her? I mean, we have to identify what was the criminal act that he committed. And I don't think when you allow the jury this, and I'll even touch on briefly the confusing aspect of it, because you can imagine a jury thinking, well, back in the jury room, well, she was too drunk to consent. And another person says, no, she was fine. I mean, look, she was fine when she left. She was fine when she came back. She was injured. But as far as, you know, that certainly is a conversation that could have happened. And then they look at the jury instruction and go, well, what are we supposed to do here? How do we determine whether he's guilty or not? Like, well, I guess it's all in there together, so we'll just all agree that he's guilty and we'll be on our way. And so that's the real concern here. And I will, unless there are a few other questions or any questions, I'll go ahead and reserve the remainder of my time.
Thank you, Mr. Harding. Mr. Uberman.
May it please the court, David Uberman on behalf of the Commonwealth. The court today essentially has two questions before it. The first is whether the instructions on forcible sodomy and aggravated sexual battery are proper. And if so, that goes into the issue of unanimous verdicts in the Commonwealth. The second issue, which the court may not need to reach, is assuming that that instruction was error, was the error harmless? It's the Commonwealth's position, obviously, that the instruction was proper in this case. As this court is well aware.
In Shad, the court was faced with a similar thing, and they said the harmless error argument is a throwaway, essentially, because either you had a constitutional right for the jury to be unanimous on how you did this or you didn't.
Yes.
So if my suggestion to you is focus on whether the instruction was proper.
Yes, Your Honor. And as you said, the Shad court said exactly that with the issue of felony murder versus first degree. Other courts have held the same as the Commonwealth cited on brief. In Utah State versus Hummel, a case from 2017, their Supreme Court held that unanimity is not required as to theories or method or modes of a crime. Under the text and the original meaning of the unanimous verdict clause, and they also have enshrined their unanimous verdict clause in the Constitution, as Virginia has done. Unanimity is required only as to the jury's verdict. Richardson versus United States is another U.S. Supreme Court case where they held that federal criminal grand or criminal juries applied the same standard. Again, it's the trial court has a responsibility to ensure that the law is presented to the jury and that the instructions cover all issues which the evidence fairly raised. And in this case,
if you can't give the combined instruction, or you have to know which, if it has to be unanimous on which theory, does that effectively force the Commonwealth to elect one theory or the other?
It does, Your Honor. That's exactly what it does, and it's essentially an end run around those rules. To be fair, the parties tried to address this before trial, but obviously there were evidentiary issues at that point where the trial court had no idea what the evidence was going to bear out, so it couldn't make a ruling as to what jury instruction would be proper at what time. But absolutely, I agree. But in this unique case, and I disagree, I should state that I think the act, I agree with the court, I disagree with Mr. Davison, that the act involved here is the actual assault, is the sexual assault. In Molina, this court held that a sexual assault is at its heart essentially an offense against the will and consent of the victim. That is the act. Nowadays, you know, the act can be dynamic. It might occur by force, especially when intoxication is involved. It might move from force to physical helplessness. It might move from physical helplessness to mental incapacitation. Essentially, it's a fluid situation, and I think that these jury instructions accurately reflected that. In Molina, I also think it's important to note, I would have used the term punt, but since the court mentioned it previously, the court didn't address the issue. They just assumed without deciding that the instruction there was error. But of course, the facts of that case were different. The facts of Molina involved a woman who had been knocked unconscious and was raped and sodomized while she was unconscious. And this court found that it was harmless error on direct review to the Supreme Court of Virginia, the Supreme Court of Virginia held that the issue hadn't been preserved and they declined to address it. But importantly, the Supreme Court of Virginia also ruled with respect to forcible sodomy when the defendant contended that he could not be convicted of committing forcible sodomy by force because the victim was, in fact, incapacitated or physically helpless at the time. The Supreme Court in Molina expressly rejected that argument, and in doing so, it noted several things. It noted the fact that the victim had been struck. So obviously that's not necessarily analogous to this case, but certainly her mental incapacitation by result of intoxication certainly is. The court in Molina also noted that the victim had injuries to her face, including facial lacerations. In this case, the victim had additional bruising far beyond that which would have been necessary to complete the offenses. She had bruises to her nose, her arms, her right wrist, her stomach, her buttocks, and her inner thighs. If the victim was helpless, you wouldn't necessarily expect to see those injuries. And again, I think that goes to the fact, it also goes to the fact of her flashback. She didn't remember anything after this happened. She testifies a few months after the incident. She wakes up at 4 o'clock in the morning in her room, feels like someone's in there, and has a flashback to being held down forcefully while someone is repeatedly inserting something into her anus, and that is painful. I think beyond question in this case, at least, and I think we do need to be specific. We talk about the forcible sodomy instruction, talk about the aggravated battery instruction. In this case, the evidence was certainly sufficient to allow for the forcible sodomy instruction, because there we have her testifying that she came to. That means force was being applied. She testifies to that. The fact that she came to and then went back under indicates that at some point during that assault, she was also either mentally incapacitated or she was physically helpless. With respect to the aggravated battery, I think that same rationale applies, but now we don't have the flashback, which relates to the force element. But again, what we have here is the injuries, and the evidence that the jury was entitled to consider with respect to force is the fact that Davison inserted his fist and his arm so far into the victim's vagina that it became medically necessary to conduct a CT scan to make sure that her abdominal cavity had not been perforated. The bed sheet where she received life-saving medical care at Mary Washington Hospital was covered in blood and a lot of blood clots. Her injuries were so extensive that she would not have survived without surgery. And again, as I've already noted, she suffered a number of bruises outside, across her body. But most significantly, she also suffered a horrific internal injury that extended, it comprised of two different lacerations, one of which extended 5 centimeters from the posterior fornix of the vagina and through at least 5 additional layers of muscle. And her treating physician in this case described that as skeletal muscle and tough tissue. That indicates force. So in this case, while the victim was not able to specify that force was used against her during the actual aggravated sexual battery, the record spoke for her. Unless there are additional questions from the court, I'll rest on the remainder of the arguments set forth on brief.
Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Hardy.
Thank you.
Mr. Hardy.
Thank you. Again, this is not an overwhelming evidence case. I understand that she was injured. There is no doubt. She went willingly. The defense in this case was consent. Whether bruising occurs during rough sex or not does not necessarily mean that there was force. But that's not really the issue here. We're not trying to decide whether the evidence is sufficient to convict him. That's not the question. The question is, was a jury given proper guidance? And again, I have to distinguish this case from a difference between premeditated murder and felony murder. The act is the same in that case. It's the pulling the trigger or the stabbing of or the whatever.
In Shad, it would be easier if Justice Scalia's one justice opinion, because he just said, you ignore this question, it's not a real question, it's not historically based, we're done. But the four basically said, there's a line somewhere. And the Sixth Circuit had tried to draw a line. They said the Sixth Circuit drew it in the wrong place, but we're not going to tell you where to draw the line. Where do you draw the line? Where would you draw the line, which obviously I'm guessing you'll draw in a way that would help your client?
If different acts are necessary to accomplish the criminal act, because it's the criminality that's important. So you have to have, if they're elements of the offense, and there are two different paths to get there, and they each have different criminal acts occurring. Vastly different. Maybe that's a hopeful word. I don't know. But that's kind of the way that I would look at it. And I think that the other courts that have looked at it have kind of looked at it the same way. We're not talking about every time there's a word or using a jury instruction. I mean, clearly we understand that. But if the jury is to be unanimous, we have to make sure that they're unanimous about the criminal activity that they say he did or that was proven beyond a reasonable doubt. In that case, I don't think for either one of these two convictions you have that. And I will note, I don't know if it's either helpful or hurtful to my case, but of course the court is aware that the jury instructions that were given for the other two convictions, object sexual penetration, were only under the theory of helplessness or incapacity. They were not. They did not try to make that in a separate jury instruction. They just didn't use it at all. That was their theory for that case. So it's an interesting, when you start looking at the facts, well, this is a fluid situation and maybe that's why this is the way we did it. No, I don't think so. I mean, the law says that you need to be clear with the jury instructions and it needs to state the law. I don't think this did either. Again, I would say that this problem could potentially be fixed with a single jury instruction, but two lines of finding and a third for not guilty, of course. In other words, give the jury information so they know they need to agree on what they say the defendant did before they vote for him to be guilty and give their verdict along those lines. And I think that pretty well sums it up. Did I answer the court's question?
Yes.
All right. Thank you.
Thank you. We'll come down and greet counsel.